to the Divided Kingdom, the evening news program from a Christian viewpoint that gives you a lot of updates on things that you're going to need to know in the coming days and possibly years. We're taking sort of a long-term view here because we can see that things are changing in our country greatly, so that there are going to be some, we think, early vestiges of persecution. Well, we're still looking back a little bit at Hillary, and there was an interesting cartoon in the Eastern Maryland Star-Democrat by that great cartoonist Cullinger, and we had the technician in the back of Hillary's van, and we saw the big capital H with the arrow on it, and he says, "I gotta change the engine to run on ethanol in Iowa, as a hybrid in New Hampshire, on electric in California, coal in West Virginia, and make it look like a golf cart in Florida." A little lighthearted moment doesn't do any of us harm on the day that we hear that the 7 people were killed in the Amtrak derailment. We're going to have to follow that situation. Jeffrey Cutler said it seemed as though the train was taking off, just speeding up. And NPR said there were some reports saying that it was going 100 miles an hour as it reached the curve. We don't know yet whether this is another one of these Cloward and Piven events to demoralize, to actually kill a few people, to inconvenience the thousands of people who are now going to have to get in their cars or take buses in a very heavily congested region. We'll have to be watching this. But a bigger storm is going to come for all of us Christians before too long. But when we're talking about Hillary, we must not forget that rather recently there was a great concern, and this came largely from a book by Peter Schweitzer, author of Clinton Cash, The Untold Story of How and Why Foreign Governments and Businesses Helped Make Bill and Hillary Rich, published by HarperCollins. Joe Klein, who is pretty ingenious himself, to put it mildly, writing for Time magazine, was having sort of an attack of morals. It was interesting. Actually, he was talking first about Hillary's big get-together at the Kirkwood Community College in Monticello, Iowa, and the high school students were telling her these inspirational stories, how they were getting a leg up, taking college-level courses at the school and getting both high school and college credits for their work. And one young girl told Hillary she was going to a 4-year college next year and would be able to finish in 2 because of the credit she'd already learned. And you see, that would cut her college loans in half. I say right on to her. And there were others. Somebody was going to Annapolis, and he was getting a head start on the information technology and engineering courses he'd have to take at the U.S. Naval Academy. There were others in a vocational path, and they were taking courses in auto mechanics and welding, and this would give them the skills to have the official credentials to be good craftspeople. And they would have jobs waiting for them. Now, Hillary exclaimed, "This is a new vision, a new paradigm," referring to this, as Joe Klein says, melding of high school and community college. Quote, "This is the kind of thing that can get people excited about our educational system again." And Joe Klein says that some people were cynical about this, including journalist Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal, calling it, quote, "the most inept, phony, shallow, slick, and meaningless launch of a presidential candidacy I have ever seen." There were lots of other reports, but actually getting into these charges now by Peter Schweitzer, Klein says the charges leveled against the Clintons by Peter Schweitzer in his book Clinton Cash and confirmed by a raft of mainstream publications in recent weeks cannot be dismissed as a right-wing hack attack. They are serious, though probably not criminal. The Clintons are too clever for smoking guns. That's an interesting statement, isn't it? When we've heard a lot from Al Cuppet, during the Clintonian years, some of the littler things and some of the very big national security sellouts. Actually, Klein says one of the most damning charges, if it turns out to be true, is that since he left the presidency, Bill Clinton gave 13 speeches for $500,000 or more. He gave 11 of them while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. He was and is her closest advisor. You would have to assume a high-mindedness that surpasses all understanding to argue that these speeches and the generosity of their funders had not even a subliminal impact on the mind of the Secretary. Perhaps the most egregious, confirmed by the New York Times, was sponsored by Russian oligarchs. Schweitzer claims some of them had KGB ties. For $500,000, as Clinton Global Initiative donors were selling their uranium mining company, including U.S. assets, to the Russians. Klein goes on to believe that there was more to this, that our government was involved in a reset with Russia, and that would imply that we were seeking better relations and a closer thing, but that doesn't seem to be true with NATO's dealings, where we're just baiting the bear all the time and trying to, it seems, provoke them into war. But Klein even says, what on earth was Bill Clinton thinking when he took the $500,000 from the friends of Vladimir Putin? What was he thinking when he accepted the honorary chancellorship and untold amounts of money from Laureate International Universities, whose affiliate was receiving ever-increasing millions of dollars in aid from the State Department while Hillary Clinton was secretary? He goes on to say there is a moral distinction between campaign-related money grubbing and the appearance of influence peddling. And in practical political terms, while the Clinton Foundation crisis may not prove damaging during the primary campaign, it may come back to haunt Hillary in the general election, just as Bain Capital did Mitt Romney in 2012. It's nearly impossible for Hillary Clinton to go around saying with a straight face, much less a sense of outrage, that the, quote, deck is stacked against, end of quote, everyday Americans when Bill's partying with the deck stackers. The New York Times itself was one of those, quote, raft of mainstream publications in recent weeks mentioned by Time writer Joe Klein, and some of what they said in their 4,400-word story was that this $500,000 speaking fee was awarded by a Moscow bank to Bill Clinton. And he's been averaging $7.5 million a year making speeches. The Times concedes, quote, whether the donations played any role in the approval of the uranium deal is unknown. Well, we also know that there's an apologist for much of Obama's administration all the time, Gene Lyons. You're going to hear from him a little bit later. We're getting into this scary, scary animosity that is building and building against you and I and all other Bible-believing Christians. In fact, this morning I was talking to Holocaust survivor, 88-year-old Anita Dittman, and I was telling her she was not aware that in June the Supreme Court will make this decision whether states can opt out of having same-sex marriage laws. And she was not aware of this, but she was in total agreement that things are becoming more anti-Bible-believing Christians. And she again reiterated to me how when she first came to America after World War II, after all her horrendous experiences with the Nazis, she was invited to public school after public school to give her story. But of late, in late years, the minute she tells them it is centered on Christ, no dice. They drop her like a hot potato. She cannot speak in the schools, the public schools, anymore. And I think it's very instructive that we hear her story and get it into our listening archives. If some of you have never heard her amazing story, which is told in Trapped in Hitler's Hell, and it's published by Lighthouse Trails, so you can look for that on the Internet, Trapped in Hitler's Hell, you will be hearing that on this program Wednesday evening, May the 20th. That will be part one. And the next Wednesday, May the 27th, you will hear part two of her story. And please keep her in your prayers. She's not well at this moment, and she will turn 88 years old very shortly. And so you see these people who were here to experience what the Nazi years were like are really dying off rather quickly. We saw recently there was one of the concentration camp guards was still, at this time, was indicted. So, you know, there are a few yet on both sides, the evil and the good side, who are there as life witnesses. So put that on your calendar there to try to listen to the Divided Kingdom, May 20th, Wednesday, and May 27th. Now, back to what I said about Gene Lyons, the apologist for Obama. We'll get into his take on the Christians and the absurd reactions, he says, to Jade Helm 15. Okay, now, he's talking about this Hillary situation in that there was another suspicious character, and this was Canadian mining executive and philanthropist Frank Giustra. Lyons says, besides pledging half his income to good work, such as the Clinton Health Access Initiative, and now according to Lyons, this is good, bringing cheap HIV/AIDS drugs to 9.9 million people in third world countries, Giustra's other big sin was supposedly relying on Bill Clinton's help to negotiate a multinational buyout of uranium mines in Kazakhstan. And he also says, that's Lyons, that he's now, you see, kind of casting doubt on this thing about Hillary and all the Russian oligarchs. He says, quote, and he's talking about the New York Times article, the diligent reader must persevere almost to the bottom of the murkily narrated 4,400-word story to learn that the uranium transaction had to be signed off on by all nine federal agencies comprising the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, that none apparently dissented, and that the State Department's man on the committee stated, Mrs. Clinton never intervened with me on any CFIUS matter. Now, we're supposed to believe that. If you heard Al Kuppet's first program about the Clintonian years, he talked about that huge snowstorm in which everything in Washington, D.C. came to a standstill, but not the weather-ready vehicles of Hillary's, I believe. There were 17 staffers who had to go in there. Actually, he asserts that she was our domestic president. She is allegedly, supposedly, at a higher rank in the Illuminati than Bill, but so in my mind here, this isn't small, or rather it is a small comfort to think that all these federal agencies supposedly stood up for Hillary and said that she never intervened in this uranium deal. They may well have been in it. It may well have been a new world order procedure, something that fit in with their overall plans to bring on the global government. We really don't know. And then we're looking right at this time here today, too, about the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership. Now, it was rather encouraging at first. We saw that some of those Democrats, some of them who still have some labor constituents, they were blocking the action to get a fast-track deal on Obama's trade agenda there with the Pacific nations. And it was so interesting at first because they were defying the Republicans, who are supposedly the conservatives. The Republicans wanted to ram it all through, and these Democrats were not really too eager for it. Only one Senate Democrat, Tom Carper of Delaware, voted for the GOP-crafted motion to start considering Obama's request for, quote, fast-track trade authority. And fast-track would let the president present trade agreements that Congress can ratify or reject but not amend. Isn't that an interesting limitation there, you see? Proponents needed 60 votes to thwart a Democratic filibuster, but managed only 52 in the 100-member Senate. Now, some of these things that were the hurdles that the Senate Democrats didn't like, I think it's important to know what these three things were. Lou Caverly, let's find out what the AP said.
Numerous Senate Democrats said that they would back Fast Track only if Republican leaders cleared a path for three other trade measures. One, to renew the African Growth and Opportunity Act is uncontroversial. The second calls for trade adjustment assistance, which provides federal aid to workers displaced by trade agreements. Republicans don't like it, but reluctantly acknowledge it's the price for winning even modest Democratic support. The third bill involving customs enforcement is the stickiest. It includes a measure to take actions against countries that keep their currency artificially low, which makes their exports more attractive. The Obama administration opposes currency manipulation measures, and that's in quotes, currency manipulation measures, saying they could invite international challenges to the Federal Reserve's policies meant to boost the U.S. economy.
And you see, we've always had this about NAFTA. We've always had this, let's be careful, we could upset the other nations as the millions of workers went with that sucking sound that Ross Perot described. And so here, you see, we're not going to be able to encourage countries to keep their money worth down, their currency, keeping it not inflated, because we don't really want America to be top dog anymore. We just really don't. So when we had this encouragement here, and the administration, of course, saying it needs fast-track approval to wrap up these long-running negotiations with Japan and 10 other Pacific Rim countries, and they are parties to this Trans-Pacific Partnership. And again, we've heard that this is thousands of pages, just like Obamacare, and we don't really know what's in this agreement. But the administration supposedly needs this fast-track approval. And the trade experts, the AP says, countries that the trade experts say that countries won't put their best offers forward if they think Congress will sidetrack the president's agreement. Again, we're always looking out for the global attitude of taking care of the other countries and demoting America, demoting our power, our prestige, crippling us, shooting ourselves in the arm. Now, before we even came to the air here today, I heard that, guess what? They reached a compromise. But they're probably going to have some kind of a battle staged in the House. So we'll have to be watching this. We'll see what happens. But all of these things don't really impact on your life and mine as much as some other, I'd say, long-term issues that are coming. And we all have to be very careful when we hear prophecies on other programs. We heard a woman speaking on a program last week telling that she had seen angels and Jesus visited her when she was a young child. But right away, we have to be very, very careful because, yes, there were people in the Bible who had visions. There really were, and had dreams. But we have to be very careful. I've spoken on the air before about a woman, and I don't know her name just right now, but she had a big series of books, and I had Lou spend this over $60 to buy all of these books. And supposedly Jesus came and transported her to heaven many times, and then he transported her to hell. So I was reading along, and I was thinking maybe this is really true, and it was rather interesting and exhilarating and, you know, just really kept my attention all the time reading these books. But when I came to the visit in hell, that's when I realized something was very evil and false. According to her story, which was, you know, see, not fiction, supposedly. It was the story of her life. It was autobiographical. Jesus actually just dumped her there in hell and left her as if he was never coming back for her. And she had to experience the horror. And believe me, there was lots of horror. And she was so afraid that he was never coming back. And finally, he did come and rescue her, but he told her that he wanted her to just be able to experience what it was like. And I realized that the Jesus we know is perfect, sinless. That perfect, sinless Son of God could not play a trick on a Christian. It just would not be true. So, you know, you have to really weigh all these spirits. You have to weigh everything you hear. So I listened intently to this woman's story, and of course she has a ministry. A lot of things sounded good. And the talk show host kept her over into the second evening to interview her. And I'm just putting out what she said. I'm not saying this is from the Lord. It could be from Satan, because Satan wants to foment a lot of fear. You know, some of these things we think that say we're going to be running into the woods this September and in martial law, they may be well from Satan, who wants us to give up fighting, you see, and give up witnessing for Jesus Christ. But at any rate, what she did say was that we don't have much time to prepare. We have about 4 months to prepare, and things are going to get a lot worse in September. And she went really out on a limb to say that this is our last president. Now, you see, we have that now. If that doesn't come to pass in that way, and we hope that she really is wrong, we will know that this is, again, a case of it's better to stick with the Scripture and be in complete submission to Jesus Christ in our lives and trust Him day by day. He's going to tell us if we need to get up and get into our car and run. But with OnStar, with all the other stuff, the GPS, we aren't going to be able to run too far unless He decides He will protect us. We remember about Corrie ten Boom. Remember, Lou, about the Bible?
Yes, very much so. As I recall, she had it, was it in her garments, I think?
Well, she had to take off her garments before going into the dreaded Ravensbrück concentration camp, and she just prayed. And I don't know whether she had put on new garments, perhaps. And we'd have to look at that exactly, but if she did, she had it under the new garment, I believe.
Yes, and as I recall, they checked the person in front of her, and they waved her on without ever checking her. She was able to take that in with her as she went into the camp, or the prison, and used it many, many times to witness to other people and to read the Scriptures and to minister to their needs that way.
And you see, here was Elizabeth, night before last, sitting in our living room, and we don't have a Samsung TV, so I don't know how good the microphone is to pick us up. But you remember that Samsung, the new smarter TV, actually admits now that they are picking up voices. Supposedly it's just voice commands, but how do we know whether they're really getting everything we talk about and adding to that big file in Utah? Anyway, yours truly was sitting there, and I said, you know, sometimes I wonder, are we just doing all this, spending our money, and just reaching the Jew haters? I wonder. Because at this point in time, if you don't believe all the pictures of the horrible corpses, and you don't believe all of the military men that about 70 years ago went in, what happened when Patton went in to the camps?
Patton, who was one of the hardest, most, you know, aggressive generals this country has ever seen, got sick to his stomach at what he saw. So it made a deep and abiding impression upon him.
And Gary Call, in his latest newsletter, says he's found that those who want to hate the Jews will hate the Jews. They will not budge from their positions. So we know that if you're in that position, you're not really a Christian. You're not a Christian that Jesus says, I'm going to protect in the bad times coming. And we say that with the qualification that through our interviews a long time ago with Barry Chamish, who is more or less, I think, a secular Jew from Israel, we know that there is a satanic faction in the Jewish world. And they are probably Sabbateans, and they may be some of the Illuminati. We know about the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, all of that. They're part of that Brotherhood of Darkness that Dr. Stan Munteith talked about. There are others. There are Freemasons, Jesuits. I'm sure there are lots and lots of people. There may be just some ordinary royals in there. But we can realize there can't be a Jewish world conspiracy. What does logic tell you about such a thing? That labeling the whole thing as being run by only Jews, Lou?
Well, that defies common sense. First of all, if there was such a world conspiracy, why did they kill so many in World War II, the Nazis? Second, if they're the only ones involved, how do they communicate? How do they establish this world conspiracy throughout the entire world if they're a small minority of the population? What did they do in the days before the electronics? You know, this theory of a world conspiracy goes back centuries. And how did they ever communicate with each other in the days long before telephones, telegraphs, television, radio, and so forth?
And what about the eons of persecution? What happened in Spain?
Yes, Spain, I think the very year Columbus discovered America, or very close to it, all the Jews were expelled from Spain. Some of them had converted to Christianity, but they were expelled anyway. And countless other nations persecuted the Jews. There were pogroms in Russia, Poland, all kinds of countries. Doesn't sound like the kind of, you know, super race that has a world conspiracy going. Just doesn't make any sense at all.
And there was at least one Rothschild in the camps, went to the camps. We know that, too. So, you know, you have to use your brain. And we also know that there probably are some labor Zionists involved in the New World Order conspiracy. Al Cuppa talked about Edgar Bronfman. He had built some kind of a large facility not far from Al Cuppa, and it was supposedly to kill buffalo. But Al said there were some middle-aged women who visited, and they said, gee, this entrance, it's too high. It doesn't look like it's for buffalo. Yeah, we have lots of anecdotes. We can't prove everything, but we can't prove that the guillotines are here. They may be, they may not. But what we can prove is what I said to Anita today, Anita Dittman, that it's getting toward the right-wing, I don't want to use that term, right-wing. It's getting to the Bible-believing Christians, the kind of animosity toward them that was felt toward the Jewish people. And Anita agreed right away. And if you recall in her life story, she was a talented ballet star. Even at age 7, the newspaper commented on her, how wonderful she was, but we do not wish to be entertained by a Jew. There it was. So what's going to come to us? This kind of hatred is really getting in there. First, let's look at what Gene Lyons wrote about Jade Helm 15, and you'll notice, if you look closely, this feeling that is not objective, it's not neutral, it is against Christians. And I do cry out again for prayer for God to guard Alex Jones and Rick Wiles, because they are bringing a lot of excellent truth to us. Alex, they're encouraging Governor Abbott and his administration to really be vigilant, watching over this so that these drills do not turn into the real thing. But at the same time, we must pray for some of these patriot leaders. It breaks my heart every time this very big cheese leader of the Patriot Radio brings on David Icke. And there we have featured David Icke, who hates organized religion, especially Christianity, and says it must be destroyed, though he brings out a lot of truth, which is probably true about the children harmed and molested at the high levels of the New World Order. But there he is. His answer is a new consciousness. If we knew who we each were, we're not just in the five senses world. We're in another dimension. And you see, it's moving toward that old idea that we're each a little divine being, and we're part of the cosmic consciousness. And the sad part is that means the loss of all individuality. If we merge back into some kind of a nirvana-type existence, some kind of a wheel of consciousness, we'll never be the same. I won't be Elizabeth Cup Caverly. Lou won't be Lou Caverly. You won't be you. You're a meaningless part of something that doesn't really exist as an individual. That isn't what Jesus said. God sees each little sparrow and takes care of it. That's the beauty of Jesus Christ's religion. The religion that isn't really a religion, it's just that he came as a person, God's Son, to die for our sins, wipe them out, and give us who would believe in him and submit our lives to him eternal life. That is so different. And I fear that some of these patriot leaders who continue to flirt with this and promote it indirectly by bringing people like that on, they can say they're Christians, but are they walking the Christian walk that will protect them in the times to come? So please pray that these leaders with a lot of power will continue to be under the straight gate, the way that leads to life and not to death. Now, we've got to see what this hatred is in Gene Lyons' column, May 10th. We're going to give you the whole column.
Why Do Republicans Pander to Paranoia? By Gene Lyons. The real news isn't that many Texans seemingly subscribe to an apocalyptic, delusional worldview that has them convinced that a U.S. Army training exercise called Jade Helm 15 is the opening wedge of an Obama-led coup d'etat, seizing guns, importing thousands of ISIS fighters to subdue local patriots, and throwing dissenters into FEMA concentration camps. Because where else would you start a military takeover but the strategic hamlet of Bastrop, Texas, commanding the crucial highway junction between Elgin and LaGrange? Never mind that Fort Hood, one of the largest U.S. military installations in the world, is maybe 75 miles up the road. Bastrop's the linchpin. No, the real news is that name-brand Texas politicians such as Governor Greg Abbott and Senator Ted Cruz think it's smart to lend plausibility to what's essentially a mass psychiatric delusion. Did you know that even Walmart's involved? Rumor says recently closed stores, make that stores, are being refitted as barracks for foreign soldiers. After a raucous hearing in Bastrop, during which a regular Army colonel, who pointed out that he'd served five presidents over 27 years, got accused of lying and shouted down, Abbott ordered the Texas Guard to monitor U.S. Army war games this summer. This so that Texans, this is a quote now, Texans know their safety, constitutional rights, private property rights, and civil liberties will not be infringed, unquote. Probably because there's lithium in the water, stuff like this rarely happens out in El Paso, home of Fort Bliss, the 1,700-square-mile headquarters of the 1st Armored Division. But just across the border in Chihuahua, according to the Family Research Council, there's a secret ISIS base with thousands of terrorists poised to strike. Hundreds of miles of underground tunnels have been dug to facilitate the invasion. Also lending support to the Nutball faction was Texas GOP Senator Ted Cruz, who expressed support for Abbott's leadership. Quote, I understand the concern that's been raised by a lot of citizens about Jade Helm, Cruz said. Quote, I think part of the reason is we have seen for 6 years a federal government disrespecting the liberty of the citizens, and that produces fear. When you see a federal government that is attacking our free speech rights, our religious liberty rights, our Second Amendment rights. That produces distrust as to government, unquote. Hey, Ted, Republicans lost two presidential elections. Grow up, Arkansas. Arkansas's own Mike Huckabee plays to similar fears with gratuitous twaddle about criminalizing Christianity. That's in quotes. All this really amounts to, as Paul Krugman puts it, is fear that Obama will, quote, seize control of Texas and force its citizens to accept universal health care at gunpoint, unquote. Look, it's not just Texas. Mad conspiracy theories are nothing new in American politics. Historian Rick Perlstein's book, Before the Storm, describes a similar paranoid outbreak in 1963. A California GOP senator complained about an avalanche of fright mail, mostly centering on two astonishing and astonishingly widespread rumors that Chinese commandos were training in Mexico for an invasion of the United States through San Diego, and that 100,000 U.N. troops, 16,000 of them, quote, African Negro troops who are cannibals, unquote, were secretly rehearsing in the Georgia swamps under the command of a Russian colonel for a U.N. martial law takeover of the United States, unquote. Back then, it was President John F. Kennedy, an Irish Catholic Democrat, who afflicted the John Birch Society with fear of the, quote, the other. Today, it's President Obama scaring an Austin-based talk radio and internet conspiracy theorist called Alex Jones. Richard Hofstadter's classic 1964 essay, The Paranoid Style in American Politics, explains, quote, I call it the paranoid style simply because no other word adequately evokes the sense of heated exaggeration, suspiciousness, and conspiratorial fantasy that I have in mind, unquote. Left-wing paranoia is not unknown. However, in America, paranoid mass movements are almost entirely a right-wing phenomenon, partly because they fit so well with the melodramatic themes of Protestant fundamentalism. Hofstadter added, quote, the paranoid spokesman sees the fate of conspiracy in apocalyptic terms. He traffics in the birth and death of whole worlds, whole political orders, whole systems of human values. He is always manning the barricades of civilization. He does not see social conflict as something to be mediated and compromised in the manner of the working politician. Since what is at stake is always a conflict between absolute good and absolute evil, what is necessary is not compromise, but the will to fight things out to a finish, unquote. Is that not totally Ted Cruz? But you know what? Ted Cruz ain't Texas. Early indications are that Cruz and Abbott are widely perceived to have made fools of themselves. Coverage in the statewide press has been derisive. A retired GOP legislator, Todd Smith of Euless, Texas, wondered if he should be more, quote, horrified that I have to choose between the possibility that my governor actually believes this stuff and the possibility that my governor doesn't have the backbone to stand up to those who do, unquote. Good question. That's Arkansas Times columnist Gene Lyons.
You notice these loaded words, Lou. Nutball, that isn't objective. And it, finally, he gets to the point, you see, of this enemy, this kind of a blindfolded enemy, kind of a silhouette. It isn't fleshed out till near the end. And then when he says this, that paranoid mass movements are almost always entirely a right-wing phenomenon, partly because they fit so well with the melodramatic themes of Protestant fundamentalism. I think that's a very, very interesting demonizing statement of Protestants, probably versus Roman Catholics. The whole thing, you see, is building a portrait, the way in Nazi Germany they built the portrait of the hook-nosed, ugly, dirty Jew who was cheating all the people. You see, this stereotype has to be built more and more and more. So Ted Cruz, whom we find to be pretty admirable, what we can find out about him, is made to look really like the nutball. And I don't really believe what Lyons says is true, that Cruz and Abbott, Governor Abbott, are widely perceived to have made fools of themselves. I think there are many, many thousands of patriotic people, millions probably, across the United States who have a lot of admiration for the guts and the savvy that Governor Abbott had. It just makes sense to be cautious, to watch over something that could have the potential to be taken into something that's way out of hand and could bring in real martial law. Now, the other one, George F. Will, and we were happy to quote him about climate change. There were some interesting things, but we've read that he is an agnostic. I believe he is a self-proclaimed agnostic. So May the 10th, he had Onward, Christian Huckabee. First of all, that riled me from the beginning. I don't like to have my hymns, my beloved hymns, like Onward, Christian Soldiers, maligned and blasphemed. It's blaspheming God is really what it is. Onward, Christian Huckabee. And so he gives this little intro there about in the 1950s, while Adlai Stevenson was the Democrats' presidential nominee, he was supposed to address a gathering of Baptists in Houston. And so he was supposed to speak there. And this was the same place, I believe, where John F. Kennedy would address the Protestant ministers to refute charges that his Catholicism would render him unfit to be president. So the man introducing Stevenson said that the candidate had been invited only, quote, as a courtesy because Norman Vincent Peale, the author of The Power of Positive Thinking, has instructed us to vote for your opponent. In response, Stevenson repeated a quip he had made when in 1952, Peale said Stevenson was unfit to be president because he was divorced. Stevenson said, "I find the Apostle Paul appealing and the Apostle Peale appalling." So there's that cute, clever little reversal there of words. Now, let's just hear what he says about Mike Huckabee. And first of all, I don't personally think Mike Huckabee is completely honest. There have been some little innuendos that look to me like secret society motions, body motions. There are things that we wonder. But he says, "Now comes the Apostle Mike, determined to save Christian America." Now you see, right there, we're not talking about saving the American Republic. No, this is a hit piece on Christians. Mike Huckabee's second run for the Republican presidential nomination will reveal how much embarrassment can emanate from one small town. Hope, Arkansas, gave us Bill Clinton and the cloud of the Clintonian family seediness that still hovers over public life. Huckabee, another former Arkansas governor, chose Hope, his hometown, to launch a candidacy that begins with a book, God, Guns, Grits, and Gravy, and a post-announcement, quote, Factories, Farms, and Freedom Tour. If the presidency goes to the most alliterative candidate, Huckabee wins. You see, we're all form and no content. Lou, I think many people are worried about the reality that's in his slogan, which says factories, farms, and freedom. What about the coal mines?
Coal mines are being shut by Mr. Obama in a concerted effort to destroy that industry. And farms have been on hard times for many years, many of them being taken over by the big agribusinesses. At least the family farms are on hard times. And freedom is disappearing. In fact, it's hard to find it anymore.
And the Global Agenda 21 is putting everything into clean and green and all the conservation easements that we see here in Maryland so that the people a couple generations from now won't have the individual private property. Well, Will says, Huckabee, who won Iowa's 2008 caucuses, aims to become the second person to win two contested Iowa caucuses. And he says Bob Dole, who won in 1988 and 1996, spent the intervening 8 years at the center of politics. And he says that Huckabee has spent much of the last 8 years at Fox News, which is dandy, but hardly the Senate. Now, here we get into a little more specific demonization of the Christians. In 1998, George F. Will says, Huckabee vowed to, quote, take back this nation for Christ and to repel satanic threats to Iowa's subsidized ethanol industry, which he says is vital because we need the broadest possible energy portfolio, never mind today's bountiful energy. Huckabee was unsurprised when a lunatic murdered 20 children and 6 adults at the Sandy Hook, Connecticut elementary school in 2012. Quote, we ask why there is violence in our schools, but we have systematically removed God from our schools. Should we be so surprised that schools would become a place of carnage? So the slaughter was a consequence of the 1962 Supreme Court decision against government schools administering prayers? Was the 2012 massacre of 12 people at the Aurora, Colorado movie theater caused by insufficient praying at America's cineplexes? Today, Huckabee says, quote, we are moving rapidly toward the criminalization of Christianity. And he asserts a biblical duty to pray for the Supreme Court justices pondering the matter of same-sex marriages. Politico recently reported that Huckabee told some conservative pastors that, quote, he cringes whenever he hears people call a court decision, quote, the law of the land. He added, this is not that complicated. There are 3 branches of government, not one. To radio host Hugh Hewitt, Huckabee further explained his rejection of the idea of, quote, judicial supremacy, where if the courts make a decision, it is the law of the land. No, it isn't the law of the land. Constitutionally, the courts cannot make a law. They can interpret one. And then the legislature has to create enabling legislation, and the executive has to sign it and has to enforce it. State legislatures would have to create legislation that the governor would sign. If they don't, then there is not same-sex marriage in that state. Now, if the federal courts say, well, you're going to have to do it, well, then you have a confrontation. At that point, somebody has to decide, is the court right? If it is, then the legislation will be passed, end of quote. Will says, and if, quote, someone, who, President Huckabee, decides that the court is wrong. Now, note this next. We have all the time the same-sex agenda, the gay agenda, the activists in the agenda. They're always trying to link the evils of slavery and racism to giving the gays the freedom to have their sexual parades out on Main Street and so forth and so on. So here, Will falls right into this guilt by association, you see. So he's saying if President Huckabee would decide that the court is wrong on that decision, he then says, in 1957, Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus decided the federal courts were wrong about integrating Little Rock Central High School, an idea President Eisenhower countered with the 101st Airborne. David A. Graham of the Atlantic notes that if the court rules against a clause of a state's law defining marriage as a commitment between a man and a woman, this does not invalidate the rest of a state's marriage laws, so the state's legislature need not act unless, that is, they wish to reassert the pre-Civil War doctrine of nullification, the right of states to disregard laws they deem unconstitutional. For many voters, a party is largely defined by the, for many voters, a party is largely defined by the behavior of its presidential aspirants. For Republicans worried about broadening their party's appeal, there is one word for Huckabee's stances, appalling. We find it appalling here that we're getting closer and closer in this media hatred to what we think really bodes not well for us, because we can hear everything that these two men wrote, and then we can know what really happened. In Friday Church News notes, and I believe this is May 8th, let's hear in depth the story of the Christian baker.
The following is excerpted from Todd Starnes. Bakers face $135,000 fine. Fox News, April 26, 2015. The owners of an Oregon bakery learned Friday that there is a severe price to pay for following their Christian faith. A judge for the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries recommended a lesbian couple should receive $135,000 in damages for their emotional suffering after Sweet Cakes by Melissa refused to make them a wedding cake. As a result, Aaron and Melissa Klein could lose everything they own, including their home. The Oregonian reports the recommended penalty is not final and could be raised or lowered by State Labor Commissioner Brad Avakian. The controversy started in 2013 when Aaron Klein declined to provide a cake for a lesbian wedding. Later that year, the women filed a complaint against Klein and his wife, Melissa. Within hours of the ruling, the Family Research Council facilitated the establishment of a GoFundMe account to help the clients raise the money they needed. In less than 8 hours, more than $100,000 was raised. However, late Friday, GoFundMe pulled the plug, sending this message to would-be donors. After careful review by our team, we have found the Support Sweet Cakes by Melissa campaign to be in violation of our terms and conditions, the message read. The money raised thus far will still be made available for withdrawal. Samaritan's Purse, a Christian ministry run by Franklin Graham, has stepped up and offered to raise funds for the embattled Christian couple at its website.
We really applaud Franklin Graham. It sounds like the other organization, the Family Research Council, bowed to pressure. Was it political pressure? We don't know. But, you know, I was saying to Lou, there were a lot of things when we began to investigate the New World Order. There were a lot of detrimental things about Billy Graham and his connections that were very, very questionable. You know, the World Ecumenical Churches, organizations. There are very, very many things. But I said to Lou, it was very interesting when I was reading, I believe, Franklin Graham's autobiography. I can't give you the title of it right now. It was something like The Outcast or The Rebel, something like that. But what was interesting to me was I think this was the beginning of his love of the ordinary American person, the middle class, and part of why he would defend, you see, these people when perhaps his father was more the elite advisor to the presidents and enjoying all of that kind of life. His father was gone so much in all of this preaching all over the world that Ruth Graham herself said there really wasn't much of a father figure. And there was a gardener, I believe, there. And Franklin just attached himself to him, and he learned one bad habit, smoking, because this man smoked a lot. But I think that God, in his wisdom, provides people sometimes who are not members of our family who influence us greatly. I remember one in my own life, Reverend Blake Anderson, who challenged me one time to go to Pittsburgh and take this job that I didn't think I was qualified for. And he says, just do it for me, just last 2 weeks. Well, I admired him because he was part of World War II, and he and a small group of men went into a town in Italy and took the town. He was a wonderful pastor who came to being a pastor rather late in life. And so I didn't want to disappoint Blake. Blake married Lou and me here at our home in 1984. I was so glad he was still alive to do that. So you see, we're going to need figures like Franklin Graham, who are real, true Christians with courage, who will tell it like it is. And whatever time is left, we want to give you a little bit more of what's happening. When we say persecution's going to come, it's really starting. You'll find all of this at Godfather Politics, posted April 7th, 2015. Lou and I will go back and forth a little bit on this. Family-owned Memories Pizza in Indiana came into the crosshairs of homosexuals when an owner was interviewed by a local TV station in the aftermath of the adoption of the state's religious freedom law. Responding to a reporter's question, the owner said that while her restaurant serves gays, her Christian faith wouldn't allow her to cater a gay wedding. The restaurant immediately became a focal point of outrage toward the law, with threats of death and destruction causing the owners to shut down their business. The Ocean Grove Camp Meeting Association no longer is used for weddings because a lesbian duo was denied permission to use it, and a state discrimination complaint was filed. The owners of a Christian farm in upstate New York recently were fined $10,000 and assessed $1,500 in damages for not allowing a lesbian duo to use their land and home for a wedding.
The Colorado Civil Rights Commission ordered Jack Phillips of Masterpiece Cake Shop to use his artistry to celebrate homosexual unions in violation of his Christian beliefs. A state commissioner, Diane Rice, likened Christians to slave owners and Nazis. The Hitching Post Wedding Chapel in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, was ordered to perform same-sex weddings in violation of their faith. In Washington State, florist Baronelle Stutzman has been penalized $1,001 for declining to support a same-sex wedding with her floral talents. David and Jason Benham were en route to a new HGTV television show when homosexual activists made an issue of their belief in biblical marriage. The network canceled their real estate show, which was to be called Flip It Forward. The Benhams maintain that the RFRA is, quote, a shield to protect companies like, for instance, a Jewish-owned jewelry. It keeps the state from forcing him to create rings with a Nazi symbol on it, or a Muslim-owned apparel company. It prevents the state from forcing him to maybe make T-shirts with a cross over the crescent, or even a gay-owned apparel company from creating T-shirts that say Leviticus 18:22, homosexuality is a sin, unquote. Very simply, the state should never force business owners to promote a message on an idea that conflicts with their beliefs.
Really, we were kind of making fun of the woman who was hitting her children and yelling at them, and Lou said PWT for white trash, and I was smirking and adding to it when all of a sudden we realized our evil, our great sin in our heart, and it was the thought, how can we even be watchmen for the Lord when we're like this? So we repented greatly, and you know, the rest of the program was really wonderful because we were cheering for that woman because she said all she had known as a child was being beaten all the time. Could we have compassion for each other? That's what we must do. And as Christians, we must stand firm. We do not hate any people who are in the homosexual lifestyle. No, we don't. We just urge them to come to Jesus Christ, and he can heal any hurts, and he can change life circumstances, because we are all sinners. But we do know that no country has adopted the sodomy and all of the rest of it and ever really survived. And Lou pointed out to me that it wasn't something that triggered here on earth at Sodom and Gomorrah. It was fire and brimstone that rained down from heaven. Good night for the Divided Kingdom.